we could become the first genuine multiracial democracy in the world.
From Interfaith Alliance, this is The State of Belief. I'm Interfaith Alliance President Reverend Paul Brandeis Rauschenbusch in New York City.
It's a wonderful opportunity we have, but it will be answering this question, who is my neighbor? It'll be treating people who are different than me as my neighbor.
A lot of awful things have been done in the name of religious faith. It's a pattern that goes back thousands of years. But that doesn't make it any less dangerous today. Jim Wallis is a leading theologian, writer, teacher, and activist who calls out one way this continues to happen in his new book, The False White Gospel: Rejecting Christian Nationalism, Reclaiming True Faith, and Refounding Democracy. He's my guest on this week's show. As we keep growing our library of extraordinary interviews, I want to make sure that you are subscribed to the State of Belief podcast. Please visit stateofbelief.com/subscribe. You'll hear this episode in full, as well as recent interviews with Rob Reiner, Jackie Lewis, John Pavlovitz, Rabbi Sharon Brous, Najiba Saeed, Sky Perryman, Jamar Tisby, and many others. It would really help us to have you subscribe, rate, and tell the people you're close to all about what you've been hearing. The State of Belief is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you've made a donation, thank you for helping get these conversations heard by more people who need them. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how to do that is available at stateofbelief.com, and you can find out more about the work of Interfaith Alliance and join us at interfaithalliance.org. And now to my guest. Jim Wallis has been a prominent, might I say, essential voice for social justice and moral democracy in this country for over half a century. He's the inaugural Archbishop Desmond Tutu Chair in Faith and Justice at the McCourt School of Public Policy and the Faculty Director of Georgetown University's Center on Faith and Justice. Widely known as the founder of the Sojourners Community and longtime editor-in-chief of Sojourners Magazine, Jim's many essential books include America's Original Sin, Racism, White Privilege, and the Bridge to a New America, and God's Politics, Why the Right Gets It Wrong and the Left Doesn't Get It. And now, already a New York Times bestseller, his latest is titled The False White Gospel: Rejecting Christian Nationalism, Reclaiming True Faith, and Refounding Democracy. Jim Wallis, welcome to the State of Belief.
Good to see you, old friend. Really good.
Oh, my goodness. This is incredible. You know what? 50 years. I mean, you have been in this struggle for a long time. First of all, thank you. I mean, it's amazing the life force that you have put in, and all of those of us who have learned from you and grown together with you. How are you feeling today, given what we're up against? How are you feeling thinking back on your decades of work? I want to start there. We'll get to your book and we'll get to all the lessons. I want to start personally. How are you feeling?
I'm feeling good. 50 years, but I started this when I was six. So let's keep.
Of course. I mean, of course.
No, I'm in some ways, this moment is a culmination of a lot of those years of work. The timing on this book proved to be exactly right with both, I think, the political timing and also the Easter isn't a day in my tradition, it's a season. So in the Easter season. So it's a book about resistance and hope at the same time. And so I think it's a bit of a manifesto. It's what I felt like I just needed to write this, given what I was watching. You and I are watching all this going on. Something needed to be said. But we're not just in a test of democracy. We are indeed, and more people are feeling that, but it's also a test of faith. What faith communities, which you and I care so much about, are going to do, stand up or not do, and not stand up. So for me, I'm feeling good about all these years, but there's a we've been laying some foundations, I think, for a time, as the Bible says, a time such as this. So I think this is a moment when the faith factor, which you and I care about so much, the faith factor could be decisive in these next 6 months before the election and beyond that. So to me, this is just more of the same of the last 50 years. However, as you're well aware, the Bible talks about two kinds of time, Chronos time, tick-tock, tick-tock, normal time, and then Kairos time, a time that changes time, a time which changes events for generations. And I think we're biblically in the midst of a Kairos time right now. It's not a normal time, normal election, normal Republican, Democrat, normal left and right. It's not normal at all. It's a moment where we have to make some choices and decisions. And that's what I've been doing all these years, but I think it's a culmination, summation of the work that a lot of us have done for an awful long time. You and I, Paul, go way back on this work. So I think the time has come for a serious test of faith.
I think that's exactly right. And it's what I love about really all of your books, and this one in particular, is it's an invitation. As much as it's a proclamation, it's an invitation. And it's really an invitation written, you know, I think anyone would benefit from this book, whether or not you have any faith tradition or any belief or just care about democracy, anyone would benefit from it. Mm-hmm. But I feel like it's an invitation. It's almost like we might call it an altar call to really reflect on who we are as Christians, those of us who continue to claim that mantle and proclaim that gospel, but recognizing that we need to be thinking about what that really means for this moment and looking back at where we have been, especially as white Christians in this country, and where we need to go. And so I just really appreciate that work. And also, I really appreciate you recognizing that this has been the work all along, and it's going to be the work into the future. We think of this is it, and then it's done. It's never done.
No.
Like the work of faith is never done, and the work of democracy is never done. And so I think what I really love is this sense of we're in a moment and the moment will continue.
Yeah, I think so. And to put it in deeper terms than politics, every nation has their better angels and their worst demons. Better angels in battle against worse demons. And
And you reference that. You. I mean, this is in your book as well, with and the reference of Lincoln. And just to continue, this is so important.
Well, we face a candidate for the presidency who is not a leader, but a good marketer. He's a good marketer. And clearly he's marketing racial grievance. We see that. We know that. We are just heartbroken by that when we see it going on. But at a deeper level, he's marketing our nation's worst demons. He's marketing those demons. And so this is a battle, not just a partisan one for sure, not even just a political one, but it's a real spiritual battle. And the nation's soul is indeed at stake here. And so I like the fact that you saw it was an invitation, because it is. It's trying to say, Jesus says you'll know the truth and the truth will set you free. And I take up that text for a whole chapter in the book. And it's like the opposite of truth isn't just lying, it's captivity. That's what Jesus is saying there. It's captivity and people are captive to lies. They're stuck. And some good people, and they just don't know what to do and think and say, and they're really captive. So it's not just you're wrong and I'm right. It's how do we together find the truths that can set captive people free? And white people in particular, I'm one. And just the book talks about in the subtitle, as you just read, the soul rejecting Christian nationalism. And I call it in the book White Christian Nationalism, and the name spells the problem. First of all, this message of that's inviting, that's inclusive, that's welcoming in the world, it was always meant to be, is somehow made white. Or the word Christian, it's the tradition you and I claim, but Christian here doesn't mean, in that phrase, doesn't mean service and sacrifice and love. It means domination and control. And, you know, it's an old theology, that you know, Paul, dominionist theology. This is new. This goes way back to Christians being in control of the institutions and running. And Dr. King said it well. He reminded the church that we are not the master of the state. We're not the servant of the state. We are meant to be the conscience of the state. And so I want this book, I hope I use six iconic biblical texts that are very familiar, but I went back to them, I wrestled with them, I prayed, I read more commentaries. And I think they really could be a roadmap for us in going forward. So it's not just what's wrong and how not to go backwards, it's how to go forward into multiracial democracy. And so to me, every movement has to figure out who they can persuade, and this book really tries to help persuade people, also who they must defeat, and I mean nonviolently. I mean at the ballot box in 6 months, there are religious leaders who are political power brokers, and everything is about power. It's not about theology, and this book is a theology of democracy, or a spirituality of democracy. I want to persuade people, help persuade people. And there's some people we just need to defeat. And
I appreciate that. I really think that that's important. I'm often asked, like, well, how are you going to build bridges? And I'm like, yeah, I want to build every bridge that's possible. But sometimes, you know, people are blowing up the bridge as I'm trying to build it. And we're not. But I also think it's really important to remember that we can all learn. Like you and I, I'm sure, I'll speak for myself. When I went to Union Seminary, for instance, and was able to learn mostly from my classmates who included amazing people like Raphael Warnock and many others who really taught me to open my eyes to things that I hadn't seen before. And it's important to remember, like, people can learn. We can all learn. We're all growing. If we stop growing, forget it. And, you know, the idea that so. You know, my hope is that, you know, some people who feel very defensive about this might open themselves up. And I'm still learning. I'm still growing. I'm sure you feel the same about you. We all continue to be, have hopefully our souls and our spirits continue to expand as we learn from one another and learn and go deeper into the gospel. And so it feels so important also to, like, you know, I gave a lecture in Texas recently, like just a couple of days ago, and at the end of it, it was about Christian nationalism and the history and the connection with racism was part of it, not exclusively, but the first thing that was this one person said was like, "Well, it sounds like you're against white Christians," and I'm like, "No, I'm really not." It's not about that. Like, but unfortunately, we try to protect what we're scared of, that we're being. But that's not what you're trying to offer here. You're naming things. Yeah. But you're offering an invitation to go deeper and to really reflect on it and where the future can be where everyone is valued and afforded dignity. And I love the way the book is laid out with these different scripture passages that you really, you know, I want this to be not off-putting. This should not be, it's not sermonic in the sense that it's preachy, but it does like lend itself to this like rich exploration of what these texts can mean for our democracy. I have to say, like, we all have our favorite texts, but the one text in this book that I thought was so important was around neighbor. And what does neighbor mean? And I do think, like, that question, who is my neighbor?
Yeah.
Is one that you go into beautifully. I wonder if you'd share that a little bit with our listeners right now.
Well, it's the famous Good Samaritan parable. And I love this too. It's one of my favorite parts of the book. So here's this this lawyer, and he comes to ask Jesus some questions. And what I didn't learn until I went back to the text, I discovered this was a Washington lawyer. I know that tone of voice. And he's, oh, okay. So what must I do to inherit eternal life? Jesus says, well, I think you know. I think you read it. You need to love your God with your heart, your soul, your mind, your strength, everything. And then love your neighbor as yourself. And loving your neighbor will show that you love God. And then he pauses. Okay, all right. Who's my neighbor? Now, he's not saying, who is my neighbor? How can I welcome them? He's saying, exactly who is my neighbor here? How can I avoid obligation, responsibility? To wash
right. It's as much a question as who is not my neighbor as who is my neighbor.
who can I get away with not treating my neighbor?
Right.
So Jesus then uses this example, this transforming example of a Samaritan. Now, let's remember, for the Judeans, the Judean culture in which Jesus is here speaking, there were no good Samaritans. They were mixed race. They were half-breeds. They were dangerous. They were false worshipers. Stay away from them. They were othered by the, like we other lots of people these days, lots of other people. And the Jewish scholars, Amy Levine and others who I quote in the book, said the man lying by the side of the road, half-beaten, robbed, beaten, half-dead, maybe just totally by himself, was a Jew. So here's a Samaritan who is an other to this Jew. And this Jew on the side of the road watched two of his own leaders pass by and ignore him. Maybe they had a vestry meeting or something, but they were too busy for whatever reason. So he, the one who is being othered, stops to help one who is other to him. That's such a transforming parable. Because John Meacham says, the same great historian on democracy, John says the same thing. Treating people like neighbors, fellow citizens, and not enemies is crucial to democracy. And if we talk about a multiracial democracy, which we could become the first genuine multiracial democracy in the world. It's a wonderful opportunity we have, but it will be answering this question when you raise, who is my neighbor? It'll be treating people who are different than me as my neighbor. And the title of that chapter is Your Neighbor Probably Doesn't Live in Your Neighborhood.
Mm.
So how do we reach out to those who are different than us, treat them like a neighbor? And that's exactly what Jesus did in this wonderful Good Samaritan parable. So the Good Samaritan could help lead us to a multiracial democracy.
100%. And I think, you know, that story also goes back to, and you'll appreciate this, of course, because you've been so important in this movement as well as Walter Rauschenbusch, Social Gospel, used that story to talk about, yes, and then how can we stop the attacks from happening in the first place? And that, you know, and that gets into the question of, like, how do we have a multiracial, you know, if I'm to extrapolate from what you just beautifully said, is how do we have a multiracial, a multi-religious, multi-background society where people don't get attacked?
Right.
and so that, you know, there's, you know, that I love that text because it continues to unfold and allow us to imagine, like, how we live together. And again, always going back to who is my neighbor? And then, you know, I think the inherent is that question is, what is my obligation to my neighbor? What are the, you know, and also, you know, inherent in that is, like, what joys and what richness can come from having neighbors who I didn't think I wanted to be neighbors with?
Right, exactly. And then another text in the book that relates directly to your point is this Galatians 3:28 text, which is a familiar one to people who were raised in churches. It says, there is no longer Jew or Gentile, no longer slave and free, no longer male and female, because all are one in Christ Jesus. Now, Dr. King, one of my elders, along with Walter Rauschenbusch, talked about how this isn't just for Christians, but the church is meant to be a model for a society. And so what I learned about this text, and again, here are the three basic divisive, oppressive pillars in human society: race, gender, and class. They're all three always there in some configuration, but they're always there. And so I learned, while this text, this Galatians 3:28 text, was a baptismal formula, a baptismal text in the early church, where they read this text at every new baptism. Now imagine that baptism is a public thing, right? These are people coming out as Christians. And they read this text as if to say, well, we're followers of this brown-skinned Palestinian rabbi who has taught us we need to overcome these divisions. We need to reconcile these barriers. We need to, and we don't always do it perfectly. We make mistakes, but this is our vocation, not extracurricular.
Right. This is who we are.
And they're kind of saying, so if you don't want to be part of that kind of community, you better go somewhere else. Because
this isn't for you. Yeah. I mean, it's amazing. It's really amazing. And, you know, it reminds me, Rauschenbusch wrote this book called Dare We Be Christians, in which he looks at the Corinthians text, which is like, what is love? And it's like, he's like, that wasn't about like two people getting married. It was about like the divisions in the society and what does it look like to love one another and really be committed to one another. It's like, you know, the resources are so there and so contradictory to the Christian nationalist perspective, which actually reinforces class, which reinforces patriarchy, which reinforces dominion over others. Up next, lots more with Sojourners founder Jim Wallace. You can hear full episodes of The State of Belief anytime on our website at stateofbelief.com. You'll also find links to topics we discussed this week, as well as transcripts and more. And make sure you subscribe at stateofbelief.com/subscribe. You're listening to The State of Belief, where religion and democracy meet.
Hey there, curious minds.
Get ready to embark on a unique journey at the crossroads of money and religion with our new podcast, Money Meet Meaning.
The seductive effect of money, we think it can do the work that God does because there's something about money that does that. It's wild.
I'm Amber Hacker.
And I'm Tom Levinson.
Tune in for a blend of wisdom and levity as we decode the path to a more meaningful relationship with money.
I think giving, and this is a little crass, but I feel like it's the ultimate middle finger to money. It's liberating to give some away.
This podcast is your gateway to a vibrant and thought-provoking exploration of the interconnectedness of wealth and spirituality.
Join us as we unravel the surprising influence of ancient wisdom on modern finances.
Faith pervades people's lives and our society. And because money is such an important part of people's lives, exploring that intersection of faith and money, I think, is super, super interesting.
Get ready to be informed, entertained, and inspired to transform your financial outlook with Money Meet Meaning. Available wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to The State of Belief. I'm Interfaith Alliance President, Reverend Paul Brandeis Rauschenbusch. My guest is Jim Wallace, author of the New York Times best-selling new book, The False White Gospel, Rejecting Christian Nationalism, Reclaiming True Faith, and Refounding Democracy. I'm curious how you understand this moment that you're in. I love that you feel like you feel good, but what are the ways that you feel people can use this book to move actually society forward? What are some what are some of the ways that you hope that people will read this book, will feel the spiritual awakening that is inherent in this book? And then what will they do? Like what's the next invitation to take?
Well, there's actually a whole section at the end called What's Next?
Right.
Asking your question, what's for individuals, families, pastors, congregations, how to take this forward? Because we face this this milestone, this momentous decision-making time in 6 months from now. But these issues aren't going to go away.
Right.
No matter how the election turns out. And there could be violence after the election. So how do we engage with that? But how do we, the trajectory of our politics now is fear to hate to violence. Over and over. Who to be afraid of? And who can we hate? Who can we other? Who can we make somebody less than human, dehumanize? And then that justifies the violence. So the book is full of stories, and some of the stories are really about ordinary people and what they can do. For example, one of my team, just with my team this morning here at the Georgetown Center for Faith and Justice, and his father is a Presbyterian minister in rural Georgia. So he and his mom sort of take care of this church, and she is wife of the pastor, member of the choir, which is often a pattern that's common. And so the choir practices before every Sunday morning church service. They get ready for the service. At the end of the practice, the choir director says a prayer just to pray for the choir and the service. Now, this choir director is not a hardline, militant, political person whatsoever, but she's obviously scared this day. She's really scared. Lord, please protect us from those cartels of immigrants who are coming from Mexico, and they're carrying disease and drugs and guns and criminals and rapists, and protect our soldiers who are going to fight them for us. And the pastor's wife says, no, stop, that's not true, and we don't lie in church.
Whoa!
So, but she has authority there. She has spiritual. She says, no, I understand why you're afraid. We can discuss that, but that's really not true. People are saying these things, not true, and we're not going to lie in church, so let's stop praying them. So that's a powerful example of people where they are just standing up for what they know is true, or saying, let's find what's true. So it means show up. Show up in your congregations, show up at your school board meetings, candidate forums, show up and make sure that your voice is being heard and we can have a conversation. So I was in upstate Pennsylvania a couple of days ago too, and all these students were there. It's a Catholic school, but lots of students, very diverse students. And they all stayed way past their class times. Nobody left, and they're really engaged. And this young man said, "I'm a white male." Well, we can all see that, but he wanted to make that point. I'm a veteran, and I'm a Trump supporter. What do you do with me? And so it was great. I said, "Well, we bring you into the conversation, and we have this conversation. And thanks for standing up and telling us who you are, what you think. So we need to get to what are some values we have in common. What are some spaces that we can claim? If you're a person of faith, I'm a person of faith, we can talk about what our faith means to all those things. Let's have that conversation. Let's create a table and have that conversation. You'll be on that tonight here, and that's good. And bringing people into the conversation, but being free to say, here's how I interpret this Good Samaritan text. How do you interpret that? Do you see it the same way, or this Galatians text? Aren't we all one in Christ if you're a Christian too, like I am? What does that mean for, should white Christians be supporting really now a whole party that's trying to suppress votes of black voters? That means white Christians helping to suppress the votes of black brothers and sisters in Christ? Do we really want to do that? Let's have a conversation. Uh-huh. And to your questioner in Texas, no, you're, what I would say to him is, well, the phrase white evangelical is even a bigger phrase than white Christian. You know, so I'm from an evangelical background myself, personally. And I'd say, well, let's take the word white evangelical, white Christian, white evangelical. What word is controlling the phrase? Mm. It's not evangelical, it's white. Mm. Or white Christian.
Right.
I don't want to be a white Christian. I want to be a Christian. Mm. I want to be, and black evangelicals are quite different than white evangelicals. Mm. What does that mean? Well, let's go back. This book tries to say, let Jesus do the talking.
That's interesting.
Let's go back to the text.
Yeah. Well, I'm going back to the kind of thing like the truth will set you free, and like this idea of, you know, I mean, the a lot of people, they're hearing, you know, I'm thinking of the woman in the choir director, and you know, they are hearing these things delivered as fact, and it's very hard to like dissuade people, even if they don't see it around them, but they've heard it. And who is a valuable source? Right. How, and this is one of the things I hope people will do is, like, I hope congregations, one of the things I'm, you know, preaching about these days is the role that congregations, the important, crucial role that congregations play.
Absolutely.
And congregations can be a place where, which is historic, truth is shared. And people are able to learn things and then also go out and do things. And that is, I think, part of what the invitation, my hope is that your book is used as a, you know, in book study. My guess is that your book will be banned, but that, you know, will only increase the interest. I mean, we're in a moment where the truth is being suppressed. I mean, people are trying to suppress words that are not their own or worldviews that are not their own, but.
So back to the truth for a minute, because you raised that. I lift up the story of Jesus and Pontius Pilate, the Roman god, having a debate about truth.
Right.
The day he is killed, right? And Jesus and Pontius Pilate are debating the truth. It's a very interesting story. And I think because Pontius Pilate, who's the governor, he realizes he's losing the debate on the truth with Jesus. He says, oh, what is true? What is true?
Yeah.
So the strong men, as you're suggesting, they want to suppress the very idea of truth. Uh-huh. You come back to hold them accountable. So they want to say, there is no truth. Just listen to me. There is no truth. Listen to me. And then that's what he says. And he washes his hands of it and kills Jesus. So there's something about strong men being afraid of truth telling, real truth telling, and they want to get us all caught up in just listening to them and what they say. And I think both journalists, and you're being both a journalist and a faith leader here with this podcast, journalists and faith leaders are supposed to aim at getting the truth.
Mm.
How do we find the truth? Be humble ourselves about not having all the truth. Find the truth, and then let's have a conversation about truth in a critical time like this.
Yeah. And then, you know, and it goes, you know, it all comes together. You go talk to the Samaritan. What is there, you know, what do we learn from people who aren't the same as we and we thought were the enemy? I mean, it's really, it's very interesting. I'm curious, like, you know, you're serving at the Desmond Tutu Center. It holds Desmond Tutu's name, blessed memory. Who do you look to? Like, what are the, you know, because we think about, you know, people like Desmond Tutu, Bishop Desmond Tutu, Archbishop, and we think, oh, you know, they went through hard times, harder than this. Like, you know, there's people who really went through. So how do we get inspiration and not kind of throw up our and wring our hands? I think I heard this great phrase the other day. I don't remember. I don't know who I can attribute it to. So I'll just say it and say someone attribute it to someone. But yeah, you can't wring your hands and roll up your sleeves at the same time. I think that's good. But you know, so who do you turn to? A lot of people turn to Jim Wallace for inspiration. Who does Jim Wallace turn to for inspiration these days?
Well, let me go to Archbishop Desmond Tutu here, because on the tour, I was hearing these two words. People felt helpless and hopeless.
Yeah.
Helpless and hopeless, which is what
totally.
You're like to. And the book ends with hope. And it tells the story how Desmond Tutu really taught me my theology of hope. He was a beloved mentor and friend. And what he taught me was hope and optimism are not the same. Optimism is a mood. It's a feeling. It's a sometimes personality type, cup half empty, cup half full. And he said, no, hope is not that. Hope is not a feeling or a mood. Hope is a decision you make because of this thing we call faith. Now, I got to tell you, Desmond Tutu wasn't optimistic every day in South Africa, in what you just said. All the just unbelievable human suffering under apartheid. He's the bishop. He can come, the suffering all comes to him. He wasn't always optimistic, but he hung on to hope as that choice, as that decision. Hebrews, the book of Hebrews says, now faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. I often paraphrase that hope is believing in spite of the evidence. Sometimes, and then watching the evidence change. So I tell the story, I'll just be brief here, it's a longer version of the book, but I was invited by the South African churches to come for a Lenten period and forge new relationships between those churches and our churches back in the U.S. And I had to be snuck in the country because I was on the security list. I was supposed to meet him at his cathedral, St. George's Cathedral in Cape Town, beautiful. Not a big cathedral, but it's a beautiful cathedral. And a rally had been called and canceled. And when I got there, it was surrounded, hundreds of military police, hundreds surrounding the cathedral. And I somehow got through them and sat with my friends. And here's Bishop Tutu, little man, long flowing robes, looking like Yoda. And he's behind the pulpit, and he begins to speak in the service. They're having church instead of the rally. And the front doors of his cathedral get broken into by South African security police, who are just thugs. And I told the story in Grace Cathedral in San Francisco just a few weeks ago. And they line the walls, these South African security police, whose arms are as big as my legs, you know, they're these big thugs. They line the walls of his cathedral with tape recorders and notepads in their hands, as if to say, you just got out of prison. Go ahead, be prophetic, be bold. We'll put you right back there. My first day of many times later in South Africa, but I felt like they were saying, we own this country. We own this church. We own you. We own your God. He stopped talking, put his head down, as if in prayer, and we're now surrounded on the inside and the outside of this cathedral, wondering what in the world is he going to say and do. Long silence, then he looks up and he smiles that signature Desmond Tutu smile. He looks at him. You are powerful, very powerful, but you're not gods, and I serve a God who will not be mocked. Then he began dancing like a good Black Baptist preacher. He says, so, since you have already lost, we invite you today to come and join the winning side.
And wow.
Then people leapt up and they danced. And we danced up. And all of a sudden, here's these military police, didn't know what to do. with dancing worshipers who weren't afraid of them.
Yeah, right.
And what I learned from that, my trajectory, remember the trajectory of our politics, is fear, hate, and violence. And the trajectory we have as people of faith goes something like this. It's faith that inspires the hope, that creates the action that makes for change.
Yeah.
And 10 years from here, I'm back at the inauguration of Nelson Mandela, and guess who is the master of ceremonies? Mm-hmm. Bishop Desmond Tutu.
Amazement.
And I smiled, Bishop, do you remember that day at St. George's? He smiled. He did. And I recall on that day, 150,000 of us hearing Nelson Mandela announce the birth of this new democracy. And I realized we weren't, as people think, most needed at, let's call it the party, the celebration. We're needed back at St. George's when you feel surrounded and can only see the party, the celebration, the victory through the eyes of faith. So that's our particular role as people of faith. Even when there isn't much reason for optimism, we make hope the choice. And he did that again and again and again, and that resulted.
That is actually one of the questions I like to ask every time I talk to anyone is what gives them hope? And I think you've begun to talk about it. One of the things that for me with, I didn't know him personally, but Archbishop Tutu, the joy, I heard him preach several times, and the joy you got just from being near him. And I know he wasn't always a happy, happy, clappy, clappy, but he insisted on joy amidst all of it, and gave so many of us joy. But let me ask, I just want to ask just a couple questions about, you have a Substack that is called God's Politics. Do I have that right?
That's right.
And so I think, is that a way that... people can learn, and also a podcast called Soul of the Nation, right?
Yeah, we even came up with that before Joe Biden took the name over. the Substack, it's a once-a-week column, it's free, it's called God's Politics, and the podcast is Soul of the Nation, in which a lot of these people, scholars and thinkers I quote in the book, I've done podcasts with them. And so it's really a way to sustain people and help you, because it is, you mentioned one of the old books, subtitled, Why the What Right Gets It Wrong and the Left Doesn't Get It. People always smile at that because it's still kind of true. So people feel stuck and they don't know where we're going. And so we've got to go deeper than a religious right and a religious left, deeper than binary categories. So the book tries to take us some of that way. And I think we're going to be doing a whole lot of podcasts. I did one just last week. It's out today, I think, with Sarah McCammon, who's a NPR commentator.
Ex-evangelical.
So
yeah, exactly.
That's out today, I think, on Soul of the Nation. And she told us a story where she's from that very evangelical background in Kansas City. And all of a sudden now she becomes an NPR reporter at Trump rallies. And Trump says, there they are. There is the press. They're sitting back over there. They're the worst. They're animals. They're the worst human beings. They're the enemy of the people. And the press are just all of a sudden they get surrounded by people. And the people came to yell at her and scream at her and curse at her and spit at her. Were her own people from her background. So she talks about that feeling of trying to be a truthful journalist and having that kind of response. So she also liked the truth and captivity notion because she sees her people as captive. They're not all bad people, but they're captive to all this. So this is a battle for the soul of the nation. It really is. And that's why I think this could be a time which really changes things. Eddie Glaude, who wrote the foreword to the book, bless his heart, I quote him as saying, everything is collapsing. and everything is possible all at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah. That's beautiful. I mean, he was on this show and his book on Baldwin is incredible, and all he's just a wonderful person. We actually, I don't know if you recall this, but I brought you when I was at Princeton, I brought you to Princeton for God's Politics, and we packed the largest house in the, I mean, people were so hungry for that book. And so, and you know, it's just a wonderful memory. And let's end with, like, at this point, Jim Wallace, what's giving you hope?
Well, when we, the publisher, St. Martin's, kindly said, we're going to make an exception and send you on a book tour, because publishers don't do a lot of book tours these days. So where do you want to go? I said, Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Georgia. And so at a book launch event, the first week of it in Grand Rapids, Michigan, that many book launches in Grand Rapids, 500 people turned up.
Wow.
Milwaukee, Wisconsin, 500 people turned up. And now we're going back to Wisconsin, back to Michigan for more rural areas, North Carolina, we're going back to Georgia, where first week. So there's a real hunger out there for this conversation. And I didn't know, you know, what it would be like. I knew there'd be some pushback, and there has been. But it's mostly been a deep hunger. And what I say to people is, don't walk away tonight saying to yourself, well, finally, a good conversation on faith and politics. Take the conversation out of here, into the streets, into our congregations, into those school board meetings, into all the public forums we're going to have. We want to have this conversation out there. So this book is just my two cents, you know, it's just my two cents. But I hope it awakens other people's two cents. And we, you and I, believe in a God who multiplies our two cents, right? So I hope it multiplies the conversation. Well, I remember that Princeton conversation. It was a wonderful time, and it showed the hunger there is for this. So don't concede the faith factor to the far right, Christian right, Christian white nationalist people. No, let's take up that conversation ourselves and have a discussion, even a debate about these texts. So I think the faith factor could be a decisive conversation in this next 6 months, but also, as you rightly say, this next period of time. Yeah. So let's have the conversation. The book is just trying to spark and start conversations all over the place.
But there is a hunger, absolutely, and it is very hopeful. And I think what I also appreciate is that, you know, there is a sense of a future that we can get to that will be beautiful and that we can work towards. And so I just really appreciate you, you know, ushering in that future that you've been doing. I mean, when I read Half a Century, I was like, is that true? But I think it is true. How, I mean, and here you are. You started when you were six, and you look so good. You've been preaching since you were six. What can you say? Jim Wallace is a theologian, writer, teacher, and political activist, the founder of Sojourner Community and Magazine. Today, he chairs the Georgetown University Center for Faith and Justice. Jim's latest book is titled The False White Gospel, Rejecting Christian Nationalism, Reclaiming True Faith, and Refounding Democracy. Jim Wallace, thank you so much for being with us here on This State of Belief.
Always great to be with Paul Rauschenbusch.
Please be sure to subscribe to The State of Belief at Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast platform, or at stateofbelief.com/subscribe. We need your help to keep making The State of Belief. Become a partner in this crucial work with a financial contribution today. Information on how to donate is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. And share what you're getting out of this show with the people in your networks. Let's get more people listening and keep these conversations going on Facebook and Instagram at State of Belief. The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily reflect those of Religion News Service or Religion News Foundation. The State of Belief is produced by Ray Kirstein and is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org and be sure to join us next week. I can't wait. Until then, I'm Paul Brandeis Rauschenbusch on The State of Belief, where religion and democracy meet.